accession number 20729, Reel 2.
So, going back to your Canberra squadron days, I mean, you were telling me about this practice bombing.
Yes.
What was the scenario? What was your main job set to do? I mean, you were a high explosive bombing squadron, were you?
Yeah, we
were
supposed
to. With nuclear bombs at that point.
Oh, no. We used to do all sorts of things like, occasionally we would go over to the Germans, some of the old wartime German Nordhorn, as we. And bombing range and drop 1,000-pound bombs, you know. But, I think they had a tremendous amount of 1,000-pound bombs they didn't know what to do with. So we used to practice what they call heavy load takeoffs with 6,000 pounds of bombs. I don't know what they think about it now environmentally, Lord knows. But we'd do one of those heavy load takeoffs, and then you go over into the Wash, Jettison area, and drop these six into the sea. Just sometimes they'd go off and all.
I mean, the objective was to practice a heavy load takeoff.
Yeah, but I think another object was to get rid of all these wartime bombs, to be honest, because they're all past their sell-by date, I suspect. So, but they were all dropped into the Wash. I suppose there must be thousands of them there somewhere, you know. But I don't think this day and age, you know, it'd be odd really doing these sort of things, you know. I mean, last week they've one of those bombing ranges, haven't they? Of all, on somewhere along the coast with the coastal erosion, all these damn bombs have just turned up. You know, all these practice bombs, thousands of them. You know, so they've got an environmental problem up there now. You know, but
was 6,000 pounds the maximum bomb load?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And I mean, the space in the bomb bays, that was variable. Presumably, it was just 6 1,000-pounders.
Wasn't a bad bomb load for an aeroplane of that size, really. See, the Valiant supposedly was 21, but I know that was with wing stalks and things. They never carried quite that many.
So you took part in exercises, presumably?
Oh, yes. There used to be the big thing in those days was what they called the Bomex. Sometimes called the groups did one as well, but there was the, very much like, I believe, the wartime 45 war. They were still in that sort of era, you know. Amazing. And Bomex was Thursday nights, once a month. Max effort. You know, you'd get 10 aircraft, the object of the exercise was to get 10 off, you know. 40 aircraft from Scampton, off they'd go. And one of the big problems then was although they'd take off at half a minute intervals, the recovery with 40 aeroplanes, there has to be a 3-minute interval recovery to separation for coming back. So we'd spend an awful lot of time on this, trying to get back down again, you know. Mm. You know, a lot on the letdown. They'd go over the North Sea and cruise climb, as they say, and then come in and attack the United Kingdom, you know, on a broad front, you know. Or sometimes you might go and do the same thing in Germany and attack. You know, the odd exercise over there, and then fly from Germany and attack supposedly the UK, you know, on a broad front. And
would you do it with photographs or something? I mean, how would you?
So you'd be going to ranges sometimes, dropping practice bombs, you know, on as well. On bombing competitions, that's what you do, sort of. Go around the houses and drop the odd visual bomb and a GH bomb or something like that, you know. But it was all based on the Bomex was all based on the wartime business of saturating the target, you know, the 1,000 bomber raid, get them over the target and saturate the defences. We were still in that sort of thinking, you know. Yeah. The days before the A bomb and that sort of thing, which came later, you know.
Yeah. What was the endurance of the Canberra?
Oh,
how long did they stay up?
I think we push it to about 4 hours, but normally speaking, you've got to you know, diversion and things like this. I got 3.5 here, and
depending on the bladders of the crew, isn't it?
Well, no, used to fly for range, you see, you'd get up to about 40,000 and then you'd set the power.
Yeah.
And as the aircraft lost weight, you'd just let it, what they call cruise climb. Mm. They stopped that last one because it was a bit random. You had to fly at different heights for the direction you were flying for separation purposes. But in those days, there was no control in the upper airspace, just people did what they damn well liked then, you know.
Presumably at lower levels, you had to coordinate with the civilian ATC, did you?
Well, no, we just kept well clear of the airways and stuff like that. You never got involved with them, you see. Never got involved. But we always kept, you know, what they call free airspace. There's only certain airways, and sometimes you get the odd conflict with the civilian people, but they'd resolve it. They'd allow a certain level for military to go through and things like that. But as far as we were concerned, it was just as far as people were flying in no separation. I mean, there was nobody, no radar in those days. Do you know what I mean? It was just luck. It was a big sky theory, and it worked really.
Did you have any incidents in the air?
Oh, yes. People have, on those bomb X's, you know, they'd want to throw it in the slipstream of someone and think they're out of control or something, and the near misses at night. Because it was still going on exactly the same way. It amazed me. It turned all the nav lights off. You couldn't, you know, I mean, it was, when you think about it, it was ridiculous. You're flying along in the dark, and the nav lights would be switched off. And it'd be RT silence, no talking, just the same as a wartime environment, you see. So, and I do recall somebody making a pan call, thought he was he did something. And then the broadcast was put all the lights on then, you know. And when they found out that he hadn't hit anything, well, okay, switch him all off again, you know. That kind of, you know, it was...
Did
when I think about
yourself,
it, no, I've seen the odd bomber loom up inside of me, you know, think, bloody hell, you know, and then keep my eye on him, you know, in the moonlight or something, but I can't...
Were they reliable aeroplanes?
Oh, yes, I never, same with the Valiant, I've never lost, I used to practice all the time of losing an engine, but I never lost one. And I lost a Valiant one, partial loss, but no, it was shot down. An engine, yeah. Which I mean, something with a very minor, it just wouldn't open up, that's all. But it was, I suppose you spend all your time practicing for an engine failure and it never happens, you know. But Rolls Royce, you know, good, yeah.
The Avon, yeah.
Yeah, very nice.
Tell me about your overseas detachments. You said you'd been to Malta.
Yes. We used to go down onto, I think we used to call them several. So let me say, just think camera wise. They used to be what they call, they started what they call Lone Rangers, you know. Lone Ranger.
Lone
you
Ranger,
could go
yeah.
down off to, my first one, if I recall, was down to Gibraltar. Which that was a hairy old landings there, you know. It can be if the weather's bad. It's notorious when they close the place, you know. But I went down there with my first overseas landing. You stay there for the weekend and then come back. I started to do a lot of that. And later on with the Valiant, you could go much further, you know. What the Western Rangers used to go over to the States. And
that trip to Gibraltar was purely an exercise of going there, coming
just,
back.
Yes, that's right.
And you do that easily.
You'd come back and you'd have to land at a customs airfield then and declare your customs, then come back to base because usually your base wasn't cleared to.
Yeah.
To have customs.
So where would you clear customs? The devil or somewhere?
Yeah, somewhere like that. Yeah. It depended on the weather, you know. And then I back up to Scampton, you see.
Yeah. Operating in and out of Gib, I mean, you said that's a hairy place, but it's just got that one single runway over the water.
Yes.
What were the problems there? You have to watch out.
Well, the danger was the wind, you see. If the wind was coming from the south, southwest, southeast, the turbulence was such that they had such a lot of incidents that was they'd close the airfield at the drop of a hat, you know. But they say the runway extension was built on the wreckage of the aeroplanes that had pranged, you know, getting in there, you
so
know.
Where was your diversion then?
I can't remember. I don't know.
You
was that bright in those days? I don't know. I think there was a couple of incidents where they used to use this silly Q code. QGO was when they closed the place. And I think some guy didn't understand it. And he went down there and, you know, finished up in Portugal, I think, you know. But, you know. Yeah.
And when you went, was it on Lone Ranger to Malta? I mean, you based yourself at Malta, would you, or what?
Yeah, we did more of that, if I recall. And we went to Cyprus, in fact, in the troubles as well, you know, when the Gnosis, where they were. The Greek wanted to be with the Greeks. Do you remember that time? They were blowing things up and shooting people and things like that. And we were sent out there on detachment for a month or two. And silly little incidents there. We were all a bit stupid, you know. I remember, you know, you land and then say, let's go downtown. And I think I was walking down Ledra Street where they were shooting Murder Mile. I didn't know. We were walking around with our KD and looked at the shops and getting one or two funny looks. But, you know, then there'd be an incident and they'd stop people, not allow people into town, you know. And I will recall this night that they lifted the curfew. So we thought, right, we're going out to have a drink, you see, down in some place outside town. And then somebody said, let's get a taxi and go into Nicosia. When we got there, the place was as dead as a dodo. Everything was quiet and whatever. And thought, what's going on here? And a guy stepped out of the shadows. He was obviously an RAF police guy. What are you doing, he said. And we said, well, he said there's been a couple of bombs in the town and we're back under curfew. Get back to base, you see. So, right, you know, find a taxi somewhere. And what I can remember, I thought the time had come. As I was driving back, to my horror on this moonlight night, there was the barrier across the road. And I could see guys either side with guns. And I thought to myself, Harry, you're going to get shot here. You know, I thought it was the terrorists anyway. That taxi stopped and somebody shouted, out, you know. And it was the British troops, actually, you know. And they searched us at 12:50 and they'd get back to camp.
Where was your camp? At Nicosia?
Nicosia then. Yes, no, Aquitaine wasn't around in those days, no. Nicosia. And it all got a bit nasty, you know. You couldn't trust people, and then the Turks, and, you know, it was all a bit, as you know. You know, we opted out of there, eventually, didn't we?
Were you involved in the Suez campaign?
Yeah, well, that was when I was on the Valiance, you see.
Oh yeah.
And anyway, about two and a half years on the Canberra, then. My navigator decided he was going to go leave the Air Force, so I was spare. And no sooner than I'd been posted, he decided not to go, and he'd signed on, because we suddenly got a very good pay rise. It was quite amazing. It was about...
when would this be? About 54?
I'd just been married, yeah, 54. And I tripled, I mean literally, I tripled my income, it made a smile, in a matter of months. A, because I was promoted, I think, to flying officer or something. B, I was 25 and got full marriage allowance at that time, when they used to pay marriage allowance. And C, this pay rise, all of a sudden, you know, there was a big review and people were leaving and, you know. And all I can remember is group captain getting everybody in the anteroom. And flying pay went up to £1 a day. You know, it was a big leap from what was 10 bob or something. It went up to £1 a day, you know, which was quite a big one. And all the pay went up, you know, to keep people in. And it did the trick, really. Everybody was quite overwhelmed with this pay rise. And I certainly was. I was living in a caravan then with my wife on an RF. It was good fun, that was, on an RAF site on the airfield. And I finished paying for the damn thing. I was 25 and got this full marriage allowance, this pay rise. And I was, when I was scrimping and saving, you know, suddenly became a millionaire because it all seemed to come in at once.
Yeah. Didn't they give you a married quarters then?
Well, there wasn't enough. And the only time you could get one, if you were a senior man, if you'd been in the services, it was all based on points, how long you've been in and how long you've been waiting. And so a junior guy like me, you know, you no chance, you see. It was the best thing that happened to me, because when I got eventually, I did get into quarters, but when I got posted to Bomber Command, you can imagine the number of flight lieutenants I was, all those senior officers down there, no chance. So I bought my own house down there. It was the best thing I ever did.
And,
at High Wycombe.
Oh, yeah.
And, after, you know, living very cheaply in these caravans, because I think they used to charge you something like 2 and 6 a week for the site, you know. And I think electricity was thrown in as well. It was, you know what I mean? It was... remarkably cheap, but no travelling to do.
You just had to buy the caravan?
Got to buy the caravan, yeah. And there was an awful lot of young lads like me trying to get on the site, you know. We had some good fun, and you can imagine, you know, all those young blokes and their young wives on caravans, you know. That was good fun.
Now, in all your time on Canberras, you were you weren't training in a nuclear role at that time, were you?
No.
They hadn't even exploded any bombs.
Oh, no. That's right. No, we hadn't. The Canberras did some trials, didn't they, out in Australia? Mm. They were, you know, the Canberras were involved out there doing sampling and whatever. I think a bit of a bloody disaster, I believe, because some of this dust was going into the intakes and into the cabin. But... I wasn't involved with that. And then when I finished the Valiant, you see, I went. A highlight of my career was going back to Big Two. I went to Signals Command back on the Canberras again. I finished my time
on
Canberras again. Yeah. You see.
Got us to the end of your Canberra time at the moment.
Yes, that's right. It's I was sort of supernumerary, or appeared to be, and the next thing I know, I'm. Posted to, if I'd got the hours, which I just about got, 700 hours, I think, I could get onto this Valiant squadron, you know, this Valiant, because they were sort of being very choosy at the time, you know. And I went to Gaydon, where I didn't pick up a crew, I was just supernumerary, and all I did there was the... simulator, and then I was posted as a co-pilot to 138 squadron, the first Valiant squadron, and I replaced a co-pilot there. Well, all the pilots there, and all the navs, and all the, they were all very experienced. They'd all been hand-picked, you see, for the first squadron. All the pilots had got 4 engine time and jet time and so on, you know, quite hairy old guys. And there's a fella called Welford, was the Aussie, who I replaced. I went to be the co-pilot, or what they call the second pilot then, with in a crew. And Welford went back to pick up his own crew, you see, because he was relatively experienced, you see. I think there'd been a bit of trouble with him and my skipper, because Welford was an Aussie, and he was a bit upset that he, my skipper wasn't giving him the pole very much, and wasn't letting him land it and take off. So a few words were said, and they were jumping up and down and went back to see the CO, and the CO said, Welford, you've got your own crew, get back to Gaydon, you know. So
138 wasn't Gaydon at this time, was it?
No, Gaydon was the OCU for the Valiant.
That's 232.
Yeah, and yeah. I was at 138 squadron was at Wittering.
Oh, you went to Wittering, yeah.
With another squadron there was 49, and the Canberra squadron there, 100 squadron was there. But this squadron had been going about 6 months or so, and it had a fatal crash, the first Valiant crash. Was I don't know whether you know about it, but they lost the crew.
The first prototype crashing.
Well, it was a design problem actually. It was a power control when you know pear shaped after takeoff as the speed increased, it suddenly went into a roll and straight in. And this had happened about a month or two before I got there. And there's a story there that's the co-pilot. It was a very lucky man, that was. The aircraft, it was a night flight, it was, and the aircraft had been unserviceable, and they'd been waiting, hanging around for it to get ready. And the skipper said, the crew sort of went off and the co-pilot, I can't remember his name. I didn't know him because he was posted when I got there, but he went back to the mess. And the skipper said, if you don't get a telephone call by 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, whatever the time was, we won't be going tonight. You can go home. So the story goes, he sat there till 9 o'clock. There was no phone call. So he got into his car and went home, was going home, you see. And just as he left, telephone rang in the mess and said, is he there, because it's ready. But he'd already left by that time. Just saying how fate is the hunter, really, you know.
Yeah, so anyhow,
he tried to get this guy, and they said, you've just missed him, he's left. So they tried to phone the guard room to stop him going out the gate, and he just missed him there. So the crew turned up, and took, which was a bit naughty, I think, put the guy in the right hand. It was a young engineering officer, not an aircrew man at all. He said he'd go in the right hand seat.
You're a ground man, ground engineer, yeah.
And I'm afraid they all bought it.
Yeah.
You know.
So they sorted that problem out,
didn't they? Yeah, they were onto it straight away. Bryce and Trumpshaw and all these guys, and in fact, took one of our pilots to do these trials. But what the problem was this runaway tab or something, and they worked it all out and decided they'd try to replicate it in the air. They'd worked out the recovery and what to do about it if it happened, which it did, and they recovered and they worked out what it was all about and cured it in no time at all, really. Vickers.
Anyhow, you became a co-pilot on 138.
Yeah.
And
no, it was an aeroplane, beautiful, you know,
compared to the Canberra.
You've got the heat, you know, comfortable arms and seats, and relatively so anyway, and the heating was good. And the best part about it was that it was pressurised like a civil aircraft if you wanted to. We had a combat setting and a crew setting, so you didn't have to wear your mask all the time with oxygen.
Combat setting was a lower differential than the
yes, if you were going to fight, You know, yeah. You didn't want to have exploded a shell through the thing. It explode. So but you never used it. It'd be what they call a cruise. It'd be just like a civil aircraft. You could sit there with your mast dangling and, you know, an hour about, turn about, have some soup from the back, you know, the soup containers and a bit of food and stuff like that. It was good.
It was very difficult to get into the seats, wasn't it?
Well, not really, no, I don't think so. Oh, no, I think you're thinking of the Vulcan. The Vulcan was, I think, initially built for one pilot, I think, and they squeezed two in. But the Valiant, oh, no, very, very spacious, yeah. I had no trouble there.
Now, you had pilot and co-pilot up in the front with ejector seats. And
yeah,
three
in the back.
In the back without them.
Well, that's with two navigators and an AEO, and going to get out the door, yeah.
So weren't all that popular, were they?
Well, it was, as you know, of course, the same was true of all the V-bombers. And there was a time, this was in much later on, where they were thinking of modifying them all, of putting ejection seats in the back for the three crew members. But whether it was there was definitely talk about it, because I met the guy who used to do the trials for Martin Baker. He came up to Fittingley, and he was the real man that had actually bailed out a few times. You know, they paid him. He had a chat in the bar. A civilian.
I remember his name, little guy, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't the first bloke, because the first bloke was a flying officer. I wasn't an Air Force guy, but this other guy.
Bernie Lynch, wasn't it?
Lynch, that's the guy. Yeah. And he, I think they paid him a certain amount. If he was a new mark of seat, he got quite a lump sum, I think.
Yeah.
And if it was the old mark, you know, and I had a chat to him in the bar, and he had one or two interesting stories to tell, you know. I think he was a bit. He tells the story about the demonstrating the rocket seat. Have you ever heard of that one?
Yeah.
When they got a standing start. It was the ultimate in ejection seats. You know, you don't, no movement at all. You just sit in the seat like he might hear. Pull the handle. It was a rocket thing. Up he went, and the parachute deployed, and he came down. So there'd obviously been lots and lots of tests and things, and it was his job to demonstrate to the world, all the air marshals and a few foreigners as well, because they were flogging him, how it was to be. And apparently he said, I sat there with this thing, you know, and all the safety pins removed, as they thought. And they thought, right, go. And he pulled this handle and nothing happened, you know, nothing. And he said, I was out of that seat so fast. And when they looked around it, you know, sort of crept back, somebody had left a safety pin in somewhere, you know, so it wouldn't go up. So we had to get in the seat again and do it again. You know, it was obviously successful. And I think he was saying how much money he got for that. It was quite a lot of cash, you know, and as a lump sum, you know.
Because you all have safety pins and ejector seats anyway, which is one of your checks, isn't it, to make sure the pins
well,
are
funnily out. Enough, we were all, a lot of us, going back to Canberra, this should be interesting, because we didn't like, what we didn't like is that the safety pin we used to put in the front here, and a lot of pilots, because the nav used to come down from the back, down the front, so get into the bomb aimer's position, he was always a bit scared that he might grab this damn handle as he went past. Well, probably would have been all right anyway, because if you pull the handle, nothing happens. You could have a face in it, because it pulls the wire tight. But a lot of people got into the habit of flying with a pin in, on the assumption that if they wanted to go, they could just quickly grab hold of this plate and pull the pin out. They weren't too happy with a live seat, you know, with this pin, you know, in case some idiot or whatever pulled the handle.